the Cloud Podcast, your launchpad for Amazon Web Services.
Welcome to the Cloud and Out Podcast. My name is Andreas.
And my name is Michael.
And we are two brothers. We are focusing 100% on AWS. We do freelancing and also build software as a service products on AWS. And in this podcast, every other week, we discuss a topic related to AWS. One of us prepares the topic, and the topic is not known to the other one. So this is how this podcast is working. And Michael, do you remember what we talked about last episode?
Yes, I do, Andrea. So in the last episode, you talked about how we can avoid S3 data leaks, and you presented four different rules that we should follow. And I'm not 100% sure if I can remember all the rules, but I will try. So the first rule is that we should use IAM policies to control access if possible, and we should never use access control lists, and we might use the bucket policy. And the second rule was that we should make use of one of the newer features, which is called block public access, which can be enabled on the account level, but also on the bucket level. So this is the first two rules. And then we also had more guidance kind of rules. The third rule was that we shouldn't mix public and private data in the same bucket, because then it gets really confusing to configure it. So for example, if you have a website where users can upload their profile pictures, you should separate your static assets like images and JavaScript files and CSS and stuff like this from the user uploads, which might not be public. So that was rule number three. And then rule number four, rule number four was about Trusted Advisor. So enabling email notifications, because Trusted Advisor checks or performs some checks to try to help us if we have misconfigured S3 buckets where we expose data to the public. So I think that was more or less the summary of your last episode, Andreas.
Absolutely. Wow, Michael, I'm really impressed that you remember all the four rules. That's exactly true. So then I'm very curious. So what is the topic of this week, Michael?
Yeah, so I spent some time in the last days optimizing our cloud.io website. And I also receive questions from time to time from people asking how we run cloud.io, basically. So I thought it could be a good idea for a blog post and also a podcast episode. So today we are talking about how we run cloud.io. So it's not like a fully technical session, but we will also talk about the technical parts, the AWS parts, but we will also talk about how we come up with a new topic idea and how we make sure that the quality is good of the posts and all kinds of things. So that's kind of my idea for the podcast. What do you think?
Wow, that sounds really interesting. So before you start, maybe we should mention that for each podcast episode, we also have a blog post. So podcast and blog always go hand in hand together. And so that's the idea behind it. And yeah, I'm very excited to talk with you about how we run cloud.io. So let's start.
Okay, great. And that's also like what I'm asking you is I need your help today. So because I'm not the only one who knows how it works. You also are part of the process. So feel free to add your own thoughts here. Okay, so let me start with how do we find new topics? So this is one of the most, I think, the question that most people ask us. So how can we come up with a new topic every week for a blog post? And I think the answer is that we are working with AWS more or less every day and a lot in customer projects. And our customers ask a lot of questions, and we see a lot of different architectures and approaches. And we can also we see common issues. So if we see that multiple customers of us are struggling with this problem, then this is like the best idea for a blog post. If people have problems with using a certain feature, for example, of AWS, then if you observe this two or three times, then this is a very good indicator that this could be an interesting blog post. So I think this is one of the kind of sources of inspiration for us. And of course, also if there's like interesting announcements from AWS, or if we stumble up on something interesting while doing open source work or things like this. So this is all kind of the input that we use.
Yeah, absolutely. So actually, we can summarize it like that. We only write about topics that are out of interest for us. So that makes it, I think, hopefully it makes it interesting to read as well, because we're not writing for SEO or stuff like that. So we're writing about topics that we think are important. And yeah, that's the whole idea, actually.
Yeah, so that's a good point. So this is also kind of a question that sometimes is asked. So how, or do we plan the blog post up front, or how does it work? And so I think the only kind of goal that we have is that we publish a blog post every week, which we more or less can achieve. So maybe during summertime we are not able to do it, but for most of the weeks we are good so far. But we don't really have a big queue of blog posts that are ready for ready to be published, or also we don't have like a big queue of topics that we want to write about. So it turned out every time we try to kind of plan the topics in front or like ahead, it limits the joy writing new blog posts if you know what you're going to write about for the next 5 weeks. So that's why I like to keep this a little bit more like open. And if I come up with something, then I just write about it, and there's no much planning. And for example, this blog post is written one day before it is published, so it is not, there's not a lot of time before or in between the writing and the actual publication.
Talking about writing, so maybe you can explain a little bit, how do we write our blog post? Which tools are we using? How do we use them? And how do we generate the blog at the end? So how does that work?
Yes, so we use Hexo, which is it was called a static site generator, and now I was just visiting the website yesterday, so now they call it a blog framework. But it's basically a tool that converts a bunch of files into, like text files into HTML. And so for example, we write our posts in Markdown. So every post is a file, and the format is a Markdown file, and Hexo converts all those files into the structure of the blog. So every post gets a HTML page. Then we have like a index page where all the posts are listed with a paginator, and we have a few like tag pages, category pages, and a lot of stuff is generated by Hexo. And it also supports themes, so you can add your own theme. So our Markdown does not contain any layout, so the layout is added by the theme. And what I really like about Hexo is that it is basically making use of plugins in a very excessive way. So we have plugins for everything, and you can also write your own plugins, and it's really, really easy to do so. So we have our own plugins. So for example, so for the index page, we have a short summary of the article, and we also have an image. And this image is just extracted by a plugin from the Markdown file. So we basically take the first image as the blog post preview image as well. So this is a plugin that we added. And we also have a plugin to support the HTML picture element lately. So this is also very nice. And then we have also official plugins like for footnotes, for the RSS feed, to support shiny tables. And we also, so if you don't like the plugin, if you want to modify it a little bit, you can also just fork it and use your own version of the official plugin, which we also did a lot.
Okay, but to summarize that, so Hexo is it's a tool that we use to generate a static website. So CloudOnNow basically is a static website. There is no dynamic content there. And all Hexo is doing for us is basically generating HTML files and a static website structure.
Yeah, that's correct. And the benefits are, and we will talk about them, I think, also today in the episode, is that it's really easy to host this website. So it's because it's static, and you can, it's really easy to cache behind a content delivery network as well. So yeah, that's really a very low maintenance and low effort way of hosting a website. Because if everything is static, then you basically don't have much troubles. So there's no database and things like this.
So maybe you can describe the process of how we publish a new blog post. So how does the technical aspect of that work?
So most often it works like this. So I have like the Git repository on my machine, and then I create a new branch. I start writing, so I create a new Markdown file basically, and then I add the text and the pictures and all this stuff that is needed. And then I push this branch to the remote repository, which is hosted on GitHub. I open a pull request, and then I ask you, Andreas, for a review. And if you are the author, then you very likely ask me for a review. So this means that we use GitHub pull requests to perform the reviews. So this means that if, for example, I write the blog post and you, Andreas, find something that is not clear or that you have some way of improvements, then you basically create another pull request that is merged into my pull request with your feedback. So that's kind of the process. And usually we have one round of review and revise, and then we are fine. So that's kind of the process. And to make things a little bit more easier, we also upload the PDF version to make reading easier, because reading the Markdown is a little bit hard, and sometimes you cannot imagine how it looks like with all the tables and stuff. So we also add the PDF to the pull request to make it easier to read, basically. But the editing and the modifications are all performed in the Markdown file. So and then also we have the possibility to add comments to the Markdown directly in the GitHub pull request and things like this. So I think that's really, I mean, it's not perfect because it's not, so GitHub is not made for Markdown files. But I mean, they can add comments to any text file. So I think it's good enough. And it works, and we use it since, I don't know, quite some time. Yeah, so there was no change to this process for a long time.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a very good summary of how we work on new blog posts. Michael, so what happens next? So after we have reviewed the new blog post and after we have merged the pull request, what happens then?
Yeah, so when the pull request is merged into the master branch, the continuous deployment pipeline starts. And basically it installs. So Hexo is Node.js based, so we install the Node.js dependencies in the pipeline. Then we run Hexo generate, which is the command to produce the HTML files and all the static content, images and stuff like this. Then we copy all those files over to S3 with the AWS S3 sync CLI command. And then we invalidate the CloudFront cache. And then we also have some very simple smoke tests. For example, we check if the RSS feed is still accessible, so that kind of makes sure that we don't make big mistakes. And we also check the index, so like the homepage, if there is a certain keyword in the page and things like this. So that's kind of what happens in the deployment pipeline. So it's really simple deployment pipeline, but it's also like, as I said, the whole approach is very simple, and this is also what we like, because it's there's less, or we don't have much effort in running it. So the deployment pipeline is hosted on our Jenkins infrastructure. So we I think we have the idea to migrate this to CodePipeline since quite some time. So we haven't done it yet, but maybe in the next months, I'm not sure. So there is not much pain for us doing it, because the Jenkins also works. But if you find some time in the future, then it would make sense to migrate it over to CodePipeline. Yeah, so I think that's the deployment process. So it's really straightforward, I think.
And okay, so that's the deployment pipeline. You already mentioned that the deployment pipeline is basically uploading all that static files to S3. But can you maybe explain then a little bit in more detail how the infrastructure looks like that we use to basically ship the content to our readers? So how do we do that? Which AWS services are we using?
Yeah, so the good news is we are using our own open source CloudFormation template to host cloud.io. So we have a template for a static website, and it basically contains an S3 bucket where the files are stored, and it also creates the CloudFront distribution. So this is the content delivery network, and the content delivery network is configured to fetch the files from the S3 bucket. So if the file is not in the content delivery cache, then CloudFront asks S3 or downloads the file from S3. And this is, I think, a very common architecture. It's used by many people, and it also has worked quite well for us. So we had some blog posts that were on the Hacker News front page. So this is I don't know if you know Hacker News. So it's a website. So if you're on the Hacker News front page, you can expect maybe like 100,000 to 1 million page views for the single page on the front page. So it generates a lot of traffic on your website. And with this setup, with S3 and CloudFront, you don't have to worry about this because of the content delivery network, you are able to serve those 100,000 page views or 1 million page views without any issues. So the only thing that changes is basically your bill. But this is also not a... So I checked yesterday the CloudFront bill, and it's not significant money. So it's not a big deal. So if you compare it to other hosting providers or something like this, it should be a similar expensive, and you survive big bursts of traffic and also very spiky traffic bursts. If something, for example, sometimes on Twitter, a post is retweeted by people with reach, and then you get a lot of visits within a few minutes. So this is all handled by this setup. And the cool thing, as I said, is that this is a open source template from us. So it's our CloudFormation template. So you can check it out. I will add the link to the show notes. So if you are interested in running a static website, and I can highly recommend to do this. And one thing that I want to mention here as well is there are many examples in the internet that show you how to do it, but a lot of them miss a very critical piece, I think, and this is the security configuration to make sure that only CloudFront is allowed to access your S3 bucket. And this is possible, and I recommend to check this out. So it's I cannot remember how this is called at the moment, Andreas. Do you remember how this feature is called of CloudFront?
It's origin identity.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. And so that is how you can write a bucket policy that only allows your CloudFront distribution to access the content. So you can make sure that downloads only happen through CloudFront.
Yeah, perfect. So that was the feature that I had in mind. Okay, perfect. So when we talk about CloudFront, I have interesting things to add here as well. And this is Lambda at Edge. If you haven't heard about Lambda at Edge, you might assume that it is kind of Lambda because the name is kind of the same. But I'm not quite sure if Lambda at Edge is a good name for it because it's really a little bit different. So what Lambda at Edge is, in my own words, is a way to execute code in CloudFront. But it's not really Lambda because it does not support all the runtimes. It has lots of restrictions. So, for example, at the moment, you can it supports Node.js and Python, and you have very strict requirements regarding timeouts. So, depending on the type of request, you have up to 5 seconds or 30 seconds to respond. And there's no support for environment variables, There's no support for Lambda layers, and the list goes on and on and on. So there are a lot of lots of things that are not supported, basically. So it's not really Lambda. It's just a way to make your CloudFront a little bit more dynamic. So you can execute code when a request arrives from the client. You can make execute code if the origin is contacted. So if basically the cache was missed, you can execute your code if a response from the origin is received. And then finally, you can execute code before the response is actually sent to the client. So there are four hooks or four kind of points in the process where you can hook into the flow. And we use Lambda at Edge for basically two or three different things. So the first is we have some legacy paths that we have to redirect. So for example, when we started, our RSS feed path was different than it is today. So we have to send a HTTP 300 and I think 2 or 301 to make sure that all the old paths still work, because we just redirect them to the new. Then we also have these problems because we use so in our blog, every blog post is a directory. So there is basically an index.html file inside this directory. And this is not supported out of the box by CloudFront. They only support the index.html kind of approach for the root object, but not for each directory inside the root. So we have some lambda.edge logic here as well to make sure that this works. And then lately I added on-the-fly image optimization. So if you visit our website, and if the image is not in the cache, we will fetch the image from our S3 bucket, and then we do image optimization. So for example, we reduce the quality, we might resize the image, and we also might convert it into WebP or something like this. And this is all done on the fly by CloudFront. So that's kind of interesting. And then the output is then in the cache. So we don't do this for every image. We only do this basically once a week for every image. So this is a good approach for us to make sure that we are able to change this image optimization without the need to reprocess all the images, because we were running into this issue that it took 20 to 30 minutes for us to optimize all our images, which was a very painful, because our deployment pipeline was really slow because of that. So, I mean, we could have improved this and parallelized it on multiple machines, whatever, but this would be a lot of work. So instead, we switched to Lambda at Edge, and now we do it in massive parallelization if needed. So if a lot of people are visiting the website from different regions, then we will just optimize the images in parallel using Lambda at Edge. And the cool thing is that this does not really affect our bill. So I just compared the bill with the bill from last month where we're not using the new on-the-fly image optimization, and I cannot really see a difference. So even though this is more work, so it takes roughly 1 second for us to optimize an image, but still it's not really visible on the bill for us. So it's, I think, a good approach here because it was, it's really more dynamic than what we had before.
Okay, so Michael, you're talking a lot about the costs of running Cloud on Node.io on CloudFront F3 and with Lambda at Edge as well. Can you remember the numbers? So what do we pay per month?
So we have to pay for I think, three different things. So the first is traffic, CloudFront traffic. Then we have to pay for requests. And then we also have to pay for Lambda at Edge. I mean, we also have to pay for S3, but this is probably not a big deal. So I think we are somewhere in between $5 to $20 per month for running the website. So basically we pay most money to CloudFront traffic. So that's the kind of number that I have in mind.
So not really a big deal for a website with that much traffic on it. Okay.
Yeah, so I don't think so. And it also is basically zero maintenance, so we don't have to patch anything or something like this. So it just runs and it runs and it runs. So that's a good indicator, I think. And that's also kind of the next topic. What happens if it doesn't run? So how do we detect problems with the website?
Yeah, interesting. So then tell me, how do we make sure that Cloud on Node.io is up and running?
Yeah, so we use two approaches. So the first is we look from the outside of AWS to see if the website is running. And we use a service called Uptime Robot for this, but there are other services like, I think, Pingdom, and I think there are many, many more services like this. And what they do is first, they don't run on AWS themselves, so this is very important. And second, they check from multiple locations, so they don't only check from one location if your website is running, they check from multiple locations to make sure that this is not only a problem from one location, but it's really a global thing. And if Uptime Robot detects a problem, we trigger an alert in Marbot. So Marbot is our Slack-based incident management solution. So basically what happens is that we receive a Slack message, and we also receive an email because our own Marbot is hosted on AWS. So if there is a like bigger down or bigger issue on AWS, then we receive an email, and the email is hosted by Google. So we hope that this will work. We will at least receive the email if everything is kind of on fire. The problem is that we cannot really do anything if we receive this email because, I mean, we cannot really patch or make sure that CloudFront is running again because it's not our responsibility. But still, we know about the problem. So that's the approach number one. So checking from the outside of AWS. And we also check from the inside. So our biggest, I think, problem or the biggest source of errors is are the Lambda at Edge functions. So if you have a bug in our functions, and we had a bug in the functions, I can tell you about this in a few seconds, then we can see this in different places. For example, we can see this in CloudWatch metrics. So CloudFront publishes metrics. For example, there is the Lambda execution error metric, and this is the Lambda at Edge execution errors. And this is a metric that we observe. And if this metric goes up, then we again send a alert to Marbot, and then we can investigate by looking at the logs. And this is logs with Lambda at Edge is kind of a problem because they are spread over all the regions. So you have to kind of figure out the region, and then you have to figure out the log stream. And this is all a little bit complicated, but it's possible. So it's a lot of work, but it's possible. That's kind of the annoying part here, but it works in the end. Okay, so that's what we monitor. And then there's also, there are two other metrics that we observe. One is 500 error codes from CloudFront. And then there's also a metric that counts if your Lambda function returns something that CloudFront does not understand. So the execution was successful, but the response is not understood by CloudFront, and this is also a metric. And so those are the three metrics that we monitor. And basically, if something with Lambda is wrong, then this is very likely a bug in our Node.js code, and that we can fix. And if there are 500 error codes, it depends. This could be because of some problems with S3. This could also be because of other issues with CloudFront itself. So I'm not quite sure if we really should monitor the 500s, because most of the sources for an error are not really under our control. So it doesn't trigger often. So I don't think this error ever triggered so far. We have to see if this is a good metric to monitor at all, or if you should silence it. So the next problem is what happens if you receive such an alert, because it's Andreas and me, so we are two person team, so we cannot really cover 24/7, and this is also not our goal. So our goal is to respond as fast as possible during normal business hours. Because we have, as we said, we work on customer projects and all kinds of stuff. So if you are on site, a customer project, we don't have time to fix our cloud or not our own setup. So that's also why we want to have something that is very stable. So this is also what we get with CloudFront and S3. So one thing to mention here is that the monitoring part is also part of the open source templates, but it's not yet in the stable release. So this is a pull request, and I can link the pull request in the show notes. As soon as the pull request is merged, you can also benefit from the from the monitoring. Okay, so that was a lot of information, Andreas. Any questions from your side?
No, thanks. So very interesting. I didn't know about these alerts. Very interesting that you explained them to me as well. So I think then there's one last thing regarding our cloud node I always set up, and that's the question, how do we do analytics? So how do we know which blog post is popular? How do we know how many readers are reading our blog? How do we do that?
Yeah, and I think that's kind of your topic, Andreas, because you also wrote a blog post about it and you also set it up everything for us. So the only thing that I want to mention here is, before I hand over to you, that we removed Google Analytics from our website earlier this year, I think in March or April. So there are no cookies anymore on our website. So that's also the reason why there is no annoying pop-up asking you for permissions that we use cookies, because there are no cookies, which I really like. So the question is, how can we still get some data? And I think, Andreas, you are the person who can explain this better to me than I can explain it to you.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, perfect. And so, yeah, we removed Google Analytics because we don't want to be part of that data collection that covers the whole internet. And so we switched to something else. And I have to mention that our solution now is not providing as detailed analytics information as we had with Google Analytics before. But it's enough for us, enough for our needs. So we get the information about how many people are reading the blog and which posts are popular. So that's basically all we want to know. And it's probably all you want to know. So everything else is probably not very interesting. So what do we do? So the setup works like this. So we use CloudFront. You also already mentioned that. And CloudFront is also providing access logs. So we get access logs from CloudFront, basically for every request that is coming in to CloudNode.io. And this data is stored on S3. So we use that as our, you could call it a data lake, where we store all the access logs from CloudFront. Then on that data, we run queries with Amazon Athena. So this is a very interesting service that I like very much, that allows us to do ad hoc analytics on structured data. So in this case, it's CSV files that we are analyzing. So analytics queries on the data with Amazon Athena. And then we use QuickSight, which is the BI tool from Amazon, which allows us to visualize the data. So we have a dashboard in QuickSight that shows the number of page views in the last month and the last week, and also the most popular blog posts and so on. So this is where we actually go and see which blog posts are popular and how many readers we had during the last year or something like that. So that's the visualization of the data. And that's basically it. So that's all we have. It's CloudFront publishing access logs to S3, Athena, which runs queries on that data, and then QuickSight that visualizes the data. And with that, we don't need any cookies. We don't need to send any data to Google, and we have full control over the whole setup.
So, Andreas, I think that's it. I think I try to answer most of the questions that we receive. So if you have other questions, then feel free to contact us. You can find us on Twitter. We will add the links to the show notes. You can also send us an email to hello@cloudonaut.io. And I think it's Andreas, it's time to hand over to Polly to make some announcements. What do you think?
Yes, that is absolutely true. So thanks for listening. Bye.
My name is Polly, and I'm happy to share some announcements with you. This was episode number 7, How We Run CloudNaut.io. You will find a link to the blog post about this episode in the show notes. Please do not forget to subscribe to the CloudNaut podcast on Apple Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Let Michael and Andreas know what you think about this episode, rate or review the podcast. Or even better, send them a message. You will find links to their Twitter and LinkedIn profiles in the show notes. Besides, Andreas and Michael recently released their second book and online seminar, Rapid Docker on AWS. As a developer, you want to focus on shipping great experiences to your customers. Therefore, we have designed a fast and easy way to bundle your application into Docker containers and run them on Amazon's worldwide infrastructure in a highly available and scalable manner. You will find a link to Rapid Docker on AWS in the show notes.